This season of the Outdoor Life podcast is brought to you by Moultrie Mobile Edge Pro.
Let me tell you a quick deer hunting story. So, a couple days ago, the buck I had been hunting came right in. Now, this is a giant, and I mean freaking giant, 8-pointer. My hunting buddy and I had been tracking this buck through trail camera photos for weeks, and now he's 40 yards away in closing. I drew my bow. He stepped out in the open and stopped on his own. He's at like 35-ish yards. I squeeze my release and watch the arrow hit high, too high. The buck ran off and I watch him through my binoculars and I realize that this shot is almost certainly non-fatal. But still, the next day, I pick up his blood trail and I follow it slowly for a good 5 hours. As far as I could tell, he never bedded once. I, of course, never found him. And if you're a deer hunter, I don't need to tell you how bad I felt about all this because you already know. But then, the same day, we got a picture of this buck on trail camera on a totally different part of the property. He was up and he was hunting for does. Maybe I'd get a second chance here. But then that night, I get a call and I find out that the neighbor had killed the buck. The end. A bittersweet ending to a sad story. Now, none of this is exactly what I would characterize as deer hunting fun. Maybe you've had a similar experience this fall. Maybe you're starting to feel those dark storm clouds gathering as your season isn't going the way you had planned. Maybe deer hunting is feeling just a little too serious right now. I'm Editor-in-Chief Alex Robinson, and it doesn't have to be this way. Deer hunting is supposed to be fun, and to help us remember that, today I'm talking to Lindsay Thomas, the Chief Communications Officer for the National Deer Association. He has been a member of the org staff since 2003, back when they were known as the Quality Deer Management Association. Now, the members of NDA are known to be a pretty serious crew. These are the folks who plant food plots and do timber stand improvement and prescribe burns, and they try to manage their deer herds and their properties for optimum health. In other words, they're geeks. But if these guys can have fun deer hunting, then so should we. Here's Lindsay's advice on how to make deer hunting fun once again. All right, hey, thanks Lindsay for joining us. It's deer season, everyone's hunting hard, so I appreciate you taking the time to do this podcast with us.
Thanks for having me, Alex. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So let's start here. I wonder, in your time as a hunter and working in hunting media, have you seen scenarios where deer hunting has just gotten a little too serious?
Yeah. A lot of them. A lot of different causes. Internal, external factors, but yes, definitely seen that. And I think in coming from my particular point of view, being with the National Deer Association, formerly QDMA, where a lot of my career has been spent talking about deer management. That's been the context for most of what I've seen. Conflicts that come about within groups of deer hunters over deer management choices.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to talk to you right now because we're like right in the heart of it, right? Like when this episode airs, it's like the heart of the rut. Some gun seasons have just opened. Some are just about to open. A lot of people have been hunting hard. Many of the NDA members, they've done their whole year's worth of management plans and food plots and timber stand improvement. And now it's time to have all that work pay off. And sometimes it just doesn't go the way that you hoped or the way that you thought. And like you see folks just really get frustrated this time of year. And I wonder, in your experience, how do we kind of prevent that? Like, how do we kind of remember the whole point of this and not get wrapped up in this kind of, just this dark cloud that can sometimes hang over a deer season when things start to not go well?
There's a lot of solutions, I think, and it depends on kind of what the cause is. And it can be anything from unrealistic expectations about what you're going to achieve this deer season, what your management efforts are going to produce. It can be external things like social media, seeing a constant flow of big bucks killed by friends or other people, and you're not, you know, you haven't, you're not one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of dealing with that impression that everybody's killing big bucks, but you, which of course is not true, but that can be, you know, that can be what the perception that you have is that, God, why haven't I killed a big buck? Everybody else has. So it kind of depends on what the cause is. You know, it can be anything from just sort of getting back to basics and recalibrating your perspective on hunting and remembering the little joys that come with deer hunting.
Yeah.
That can kind of get you back on track. It can be, you know, literally turn your phone off. If it's social media that is sort of messing up your perspective and sort of spoiling hunting for you because you feel like, you know, everybody else is getting deer and you're not, you know, quit looking.
Yeah.
Or you know, maybe even embrace the other folks. Embrace it. Click like.
Yeah.
You know, go in and comment and congratulate them. Make it about them instead of about you. You know, so there's different ways, different solutions, and it depends on the problem. There's a lot of problems, even things like how much it costs, how to find a place to hunt. You lose your hunting land, you know, in the middle of deer season or something like that. You know, there's a lot of different causes that can affect our enjoyment of deer hunting, and how you respond just sort of depends on what situation you're dealing with.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the social media element, that's the one that everyone kind of likes to talk about because, you know, if you're a deer hunter and you're on social media, like I am and like you are too, this time of year, you just see a lot of that type of content. And it's because the way that the algorithm works, right? Like if you see a post with a big buck that your friend shot or that influencer that you follow shot and you engage with that post, you're going to see more of that. And you engage with those posts then, or at least read them or look at them, and then the algorithm just feeds you more, and it feels then like the entire world has killed a booner this year and you haven't. But that's just because Instagram or whatever social media app you're using is just feeding you every single post about a trophy deer that has been killed. And then the same thing goes for, like, I think it's becoming more common for people to kind of post their true stories about hitting it or wounding a deer and not recovering it. You know, like you could probably talk about this, but kind of at a certain point in outdoor media, we didn't really talk about wounding deer very much. And now it's kind of become more, well, we should tell the whole story of hunting and, you know, wounding deer is, we try to minimize that, but it is part of hunting and it does happen. So we're going to talk about that on occasion. And people will post about that. Well, if you engage with that post, you're going to get fed a whole bunch more. And then all of a sudden, it's going to feel like the whole hunting media world is wounding animals. Where really, the algorithm is just feeding you those posts specifically because you engaged with the first one. So I'm curious if you have any kind of like commentary. I mean, you've been at this for a long time of just like how just kind of general media and the influencer world has kind of shaped our social media viewing too.
Yeah, it's you know, it's easy to bash the media and say, you know, damn media, they're the ones creating the problem. And certainly there's a little bit of that. Certainly the media, and I'm speaking about all of us, I'm not pointing any fingers here, but you know, there's some blame to go around. I mean, we are now in an attention economy, a click economy, if you want to call it that. And so a lot of content, a lot of headlines are written to get clicks rather than, you know, written or created or planned to support hunters, to inform hunters, to empower hunters, to talk about our culture and our community, to talk about issues that are important or find solutions. That's just the way it is. I don't know. It's kind of like when people say, yeah, the evening news is nothing but bad news and bloodshed and crime. I wish they'd do happy stories. You know, we all know that's probably not going to happen.
Right.
So, again, it comes back. There's a certain amount of this comes back to you and you put on you to keep your perspective and realize to be aware of the algorithm and what it's doing to you. And so while we can talk about the responsibility of media in this, again, we got to also talk about our individual responsibility again to realize when it's becoming a problem for you, turn it off, you know,
yeah.
Particularly if you're in the deer stand, quit flipping through social media.
Yeah.
Pay attention to the moment, be mindful of nature and where you are. And right then, you know, you're experiencing some of the small joys of being a deer hunter, just sitting in the woods.
Yeah, man, that's so true. I feel like if you ask hunters kind of why they enjoy deer hunting, one of their top five reasons for sure across the board is spending time in nature. But then we go out there and sit in our stand and look at our phone. Like, it's kind of counterintuitive. So, yeah, leave it in the truck.
Yeah, I tell people the number one way to see more mature bucks during the rut is leave your phone at the bottom of the tree.
Yeah, pretty easy one. You know, one of the things you mentioned is expectations and just kind of having realistic expectations of, you know, kind of your what a successful outcome for your hunt would look like. And one of the things I'm curious about, because we just hear more about it and, you know, we write more about it, is do you think that more hunters are kind of focusing on age class these days? Age class of their deer, bucks or does, rather than focusing on inches of antler, which, you know, 160 class buck or we only shoot 140s, like that has kind of been the trend, but it seems now maybe folks are focusing more on some other elements of the harvest.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. That hunters talk more about age now than they ever have. Now, whether we talk more about age than we do about score now, I don't know. It'd be completely anecdotal to say, yeah, I think we do. But I do think we do. You know, there's a trend line. Obviously, scoring goes back further in history. We've had that for decades now when the Boone and Crockett Club came up with the system. And so before we had trail cameras and a quality deer management philosophy that we talked about and could really think about bucks in terms of them, an individual buck being out there more than a season, we didn't really think about age. But then 1990s, you know, QDM became really the buzzword in deer hunting. More and more people wanting to practice that. At the same time, the trail cameras burst onto the scene. And all of a sudden, you know, you could run your camera and begin to notice that, wait, I think that's the same buck I was, you know, from last year that I've got pictures of. So all these things kind of come together. QDM, you know, folks talking about how improving a deer population means improving the number of bucks of adult age in the adult age classes. That really started the conversation and the awareness of age. So the age focus is newer in terms of our deer hunting history than scoring. But I certainly think that today age is probably, you know, more dominant and certainly has greater awareness among the average deer hunter. Mm. And I think that's great because age is kind of the great leveler. You know, for me in coastal Georgia,
yeah,
a 5.5-year-old buck means the same thing as a 5.5-year-old buck in Ohio. Who cares what they score? Both are difficult to produce and hunt and see, regardless of where you're located. But, you know, score enters the picture and all of a sudden you've got regionality. Things aren't equal in terms of, you know, what the top end buck means in Ohio versus or Iowa versus, you know, coastal Georgia. So we love talking about age. It's certainly what you should talk about when you're trying to manage a deer population. And I've, you know, we see that score still has value and it's always going to be there. People are always going to be talking about that. It's kind of gives you a reference point. You know, I can tell you, that's a 160 class buck, and we kind of both know exactly what we're talking about. You can visualize that, but you can't really use score in management. You got to be talking about age because score overlaps age classes, And like you said a minute ago, you can kind of get into trouble if you're managing deer by score. And we like to talk about age. But anyway, yes, I think more and more hunters are talking about age. And that, that again, it does help somewhat with hunter satisfaction, because you can, rather than expecting that I'm going to kill a 160 class buck in coastal Georgia, which I'm not, because everybody on social media is killing, you know, is killing 160 class bucks in the Midwest or better.
Don't worry, Lindsay. I live in Minnesota, and not everyone is shooting 160s up here. I can promise you that.
That can be the impression you get from looking at social media, but you know what I'm saying. It's a different. There's a different average score, and
for sure.
But I can set myself the goal of wanting to see and kill a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old or whatever that might be anywhere where there are whitetails, and that's achievable.
Yeah. How about just shooting does? I've definitely seen this play out. You know, you're hunting this big buck, or your target deer, whatever you want to call it, mature buck. Everyone kind of has a different idea of what they're going after. And maybe the neighbor shoots that, or maybe your buddy does, or whatever, and your hunt for that deer is over. I think folks, myself included at times, can get pretty frustrated at that point. But there's still a lot of good deer hunting to be had. One, you never know what other deer could show up. But two, like most of us where we live, there needs to be some doe harvest in a lot of areas. And you guys have covered this through NDA probably better than anyone. So talk to me about that and how maybe that could be kind of a fun part of the hunting season that maybe people don't give quite enough credit.
Yeah, and I'm a doe hunter. I love to hunt does. There's a lot of fun in that for me for a lot of reasons. You know, there's the management benefits, knowing that what you're doing is beneficial to the population, that is helping ensure a balance between the number of deer out there and their habitat, which means healthier deer, healthier fawns, better hunting, really, because when you're managing that buck to doe ratio, things like grunt calls and rattling work better. So there's that side of it. There's, you know, the challenge of hunting and killing a mature doe. I mean, an old doe to me is just as smart and just as cagey as any mature buck around, if not more so. So it can be a real challenge, and I love doing that. I mean, I've got, just like bucks, I've got trail camera pictures over the years of does that were clear to me were extremely old. From, you know, their body conformation, from torn ears and scars, and just, you know, very clearly a doe nearing the end of its, you know, healthy life span. And I wanted to see and harvest those deer, if for nothing else than to, you know, see that jawbone and find out how old was that deer.
Yeah.
And never did.
Yeah.
They are extremely difficult animals. They didn't get that old being dumb. And so last year I killed a doe with my bow that ended up aging 8.5 by Seminum annuli.
Wow.
By Maxson's lab. And that's my oldest documented deer that I've ever killed in terms of, you know, a Seminum age. And that was, you know, I was proud of that deer. I knew from looking at the jawbone immediately that she was fully mature and probably pretty old. That's why I sent the tooth off to Maxson's to find out. But, you know, she came in with a group of does, and she was stomping and snorting. She never looked at me, and I had the wind, but clearly she knew somehow the situation wasn't good. And I could tell she was the biggest and oldest doe in the group, and that was the one I wanted. And I got, you know, fortunately enough, before she blew every deer out of there, I got a shot and got her, and she was 8.5. And those jawbones are right here by my desk, on a ring, you know, hanging on the wall. I'm proud of that deer. So there's that part of it.
Yeah.
There's, of course, the venison, you know. So, yeah, I know a lot of people that are like, yo, my bucket list is to go to the Midwest and, you know, kill a really high scoring buck. My bucket list is to go to the Midwest and kill a 200-pound doe. That's what I want to do. Because in coastal Georgia, you know, a 100-pound doe is a really big grown doe.
Yeah.
And I want to hold up the backstraps of a 200-pound doe.
You know, we're kind of laughing in, like, this idea of, like, the trophy doe. This is actually, I mean, you're making a really great point. Like, I would challenge any serious deer hunter listening to this to think back to the encounters where they've been busted at times where they didn't think that they would get busted. I bet that most times that is going to be a mature doe and not a buck. Especially this time of year, the rutting bucks, like, they come in just on a, you know, for the most part, of course, there are more, every different deer has different personalities, but for the most part, a lot of these bucks are just tromping through the woods, chasing. They're not as alert as does that come into a setup just on edge. And any little move you, any little mistake you make, they're going to catch you. So this idea of kind of sharpening your hunting skill and testing your hunting ability on does, mature does, that's a good one. I really hadn't considered this.
Well, think about it. All of us want to kill a nice buck, right? Everybody's after all the bucks.
Yeah.
Not everybody's after a really big doe. So it's almost like your own little competition there with yourself. You know, you're not hunting against everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah, true. Yeah. The neighbors aren't all sending you photos saying, hey, we got this doe too. We're going to try to get right. her before you do.
Right.
Can I tell you a doe encounter that I had a couple years ago?
Please do.
So I was hunting over a cut cornfield. And it was an afternoon hunt, and I had hiked in at like noon, and like 3 hours later, these does came out to the field from like 200 yards away, and the biggest doe of the group cut my trail that I walked in on, and she followed my trail through that cornfield until she got about, I was bow hunting, she got about 50 yards away from me. And then she circled downwind of my stand into the woods, circled downwind and got downwind of me and busted me and blew for like 30 minutes and blew out every deer in that field the entire hunt. And I was like, wow, this doe tracked me down and busted me. It's amazing. I've never seen a buck do that. Like, didn't just smell my track and spook. She followed it to my stand. Knew that she was far enough away that I couldn't shoot her, and then busted me.
They are not dumb. Like you said, I mean, during the rut, bucks can be a little bit oblivious. That's why we, you know, kill as many mature bucks as we do. If it wasn't for the rut and for them to kind of drop their guard for a few weeks, we'd see a lot fewer mature bucks. So, yeah, but the does aren't that way. They don't drop their guard. And that's, there is a such thing as a trophy doe.
What do you think about the idea of just being like, I'll just shoot my does later at the end of the year? What do you think about that? Or should we just get in there if we see a nice doe that's in range close? Should we harvest her now?
Anytime. I always say you ought to do it early. If you've got a target doe harvest you're trying to meet, you know, doe harvest varies. Not everybody needs to take does, but the truth is most of us do.
Yeah.
At the very least, most of us should be taking a doe for every buck we harvest. And across time, many of us need to take more than a doe per buck to maintain that balance. So not everybody needs to do that. But when you do have a doe harvest goal you're trying to meet, do it early. Do it anytime. And I even do it during the rut. Now, a lot of people believe, no, you don't want to go in there and booger up a buck you're hunting by shooting does. But I've seen this. Grant Woods has got a great YouTube video on his channel where he documented this, where you shoot a doe, she's down on the ground near you in your area, and a buck comes along, and what does he do? He's going to go over there, and he's going to check it out. That's the best buck attractant you can have. Hmm. There's nothing better than the real thing lying there, the scent, the sight. During the rut, far from being alarmed by that, bucks will be drawn in, they'll linger, they'll circle, and, you know, like I said in Grant's video, he's documented this where literally the buck tries to get the doe to stand up. And
yeah,
a friend of mine documented this in Georgia last year. He asked me about it. He said, I've never seen this before. I said, yes, what's going on? It's the rut. Here's a doe laying right there.
Yeah.
They're not spooked by the fact that this doe is apparent. You know, they don't seem to be aware that the deer is dead.
Right.
As long as they didn't see you, you know, put an arrow through her, or see, you know, standing there when you touch off the gun. Once the doe's down there in your area, that's a great buck attractant. So,
yeah,
you know, if you're trying to get your doe harvest, don't hesitate even during the rut to do it. Because the truth is, if you put that off, there's a lot of factors that can then make it more difficult to get the doe harvest done. Number one, you know, like we're talking about, just like bucks, does feel the pressure too. So by late in the season, you know, they're more wary than they were at the beginning.
Yeah.
Button bucks are now almost as big as the does that they're with. And so they're more, you know, as big than as the does that they're with. So they're more difficult to separate. It's easier to make a mistake on a button buck when you're trying to get a doe. Yeah, it's a lot of reasons why we say if you got a doe harvest goal, start getting it from day one. Season opens, any weapon, any season, any opportunity. If she's standing broadside and giving you a shot, you ought to take it.
We'll be right back after the break.
This season of the Outdoor Life podcast is brought to you by Moultrie Mobile Edge Pro. This is one of the most advanced and smartest wireless trail cameras. The Moultrie Mobile Edge Pro automatically finds and connects to the strongest cell signal in your area, no matter the carrier. Plus, no more SD cards. Even better, it eliminates false triggered images with AI technology built directly into the camera. This allows its smart capture technology to send only the images you want. If buck images are what you want, then buck images are what you get. It also incorporates smart zone tech, allowing you to turn off custom zones where tree limbs or tall grass cause your camera to take endless photos of nothing, which rob your camera of battery life and fills your gallery with junk images. It has the easiest activation and setup of any cell camera on the market, and it sends HD video and images to your cell phone via the Moultrie mobile app. This is the most feature-rich app available, and it will enhance your scouting and hunting experience. The Edge Pro sells for $179.99 nationwide or at MoultrieMobile.com.
Switching gears back to the bucks now, which regardless of how much we promote trophy doe hunting, folks are still going to want to, you know, target bucks, and you can't blame them for that. I think one of the most common areas of frustration for folks who are trying to manage a property or manage a deer herd is when they've got their program going, they're kind of doing what they think is best, and those dang neighbors, they just keep shooting the younger bucks. What do you do about that?
So this is kind of one of the biggest mistakes in perspective that hunters make when they're doing deer management. And that is thinking of deer in terms of individual animals rather than a population. You're trying to manage a population.
Yeah.
You're not managing individual animals. And so what happens to an individual animal, while it might be negative for that individual animal, isn't always necessarily negative for the population. So, you know, the big buck that you've named, that you've got on camera for 4 years, when he wraps himself around an 18-wheeler, that's not good. You know, you're not happy about that. But from a population standpoint, that might be, you know, a non-measurable impact on the deer population.
Right.
If a poacher gets that deer, if a guest shoots a button buck, if, you know, that's a negative outcome for that button buck, but it's not necessarily detrimental to your population management efforts. If overall you're moving bucks into the older age classes and you're taking some does and bringing them into balance that way, if overall your management efforts are working, a few negatives aren't the end of the world. Somebody's, you know, wants to take a yearling buck for their first deer. Again, that's not the end of the world from your deer management standpoint. If a neighbor kills a 2.5-year-old, it's not the end of the world. And that's the perspective you've got to have, because, you know, I try to, like, on our family land in coastal Georgia, we've got a lot of folks around us that do take deer of any age, bucks of any age. We've got a lot of folks around us that don't, who are like us, who are looking for an older deer, an adult buck. But there's a few that will take any deer. And you just have to remember that, look back at our achievements and how far we've come in our achievements in deer management and how much better deer hunting is today for us than it used to be since we do deer management. And we achieve that despite the fact that some yearlings and 2.5-year-olds were getting killed by neighbors. So that's the thing to remember. One deer, a couple of deer, might be a bad outcome in your view, but it isn't necessarily a measurable impact on the population as long as you're still, you know, getting moving most deer into the age classes you're trying to do. But the other thing to remember about neighbors is we often imagine a worse situation than it really is. I see this many times. People sit in deer camp, a gun goes off, and everybody rolls their eyes. Oh, Lord, they just shot a little buck. They're over there shooting all our bucks.
Yeah.
How do you know? All you heard was a gunshot. We assume the worst. The neighbor is always a boogeyman. And what I find out is when you come to meet the neighbor,
right?
The neighbor is trying to do what you're doing, but they're sitting over there in their camp going, hearing you shoot and going, oh, that SOB over there is shooting all the little bucks. You're assuming the worst. So what I tell people is get to know your neighbors, you know, be proactive.
Yeah.
Not that you're trying to pressure them to do anything from a deer hunting standpoint, but at least just get to know them as a neighbor. What you're going to find is in most cases, most of your neighbors are kind of on the same page as you when it comes to deer management.
Yeah.
Not all of them. And that's okay. If you got 10 neighbors and you get to know 7 or 8 of them and find out that they're kind of on the same page and want to move some bucks into older age classes and not pressure yearlings, but 2 or 3 are not, you know, with you, that's okay. You're still across the landscape. Most yearlings are getting protected and moved into older age classes, and you can achieve a lot with that, despite the fact that there's still some people in the area that will take any buck they want. And that's fine. I mean, if the deer's legal and the deer makes them happy, you know, my hat's off to them. But it's just remembering that you're trying to move the needle at a population level, and so you can't get too hyper-focused on what happens to individual deer. Like the big buck that got poached or hit by a car. Like the button buck that, you know, a guest of yours accidentally shot. Don't get all up in arms about that, because biologically, there's no impact.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you're just kind of you're also talking about a longer term view. Like if we're going to look at this from like a management, wildlife management standpoint, we have to take a longer view than just this season or this week or this one day where this one buck got killed.
Yes. You know, that comes back to kind of the realistic expectations, too. People are new to QDM and they want to try to improve a deer population. You don't start out, particularly in an area where QDM hasn't been the dominant philosophy among the deer hunters. You don't start out going, I want to kill a 5.5-year-old buck. How many years does it take to produce a 5.5-year-old buck? Right. And if there's none in the area.
Yeah. And the truth is, it's probably going to be more than 5.5 because you're not going to shoot the first one that you produce.
That's probably. Right. I mean, bucks die of all kinds of things. Bucks live hard lives.
Yeah.
They have a higher natural mortality rate than does do, even take away hunting mortality. But especially with hunting mortality, bucks have a higher death rate naturally over time. Fewer of them make it to those ages. And so, yeah, be realistic. This is one of the things we've taught for years is in terms of happiness with your results. You know, if you've never killed a 2.5-year-old buck, that's where you should start.
Yeah.
And once you do that, then you move it up. Hey, I've done that. Let's try for a 3.5-year-old now. So you got to have realistic expectations. Now, you might be hunting in an area where everybody around you has been doing QDM for a while. And there's already a lot of 3-year-olds out there, maybe some older deer, and you could maybe move it up sooner. But that's where you've got to have some awareness of the history of management on the place you're hunting, the deer herd that's out there, and what's realistic for you and your experience level and the other hunters that are with you in that group and their experience level and what they expect to take out of that. You know, if you're with a group of hunters and you're on a couple hundred acres and everybody's got a teenage son who wants to kill a yearling buck this year, and, you know, 10 yearlings get dropped, that's going to have a statistical impact on buck age structure down the line. But 1 yearling, 2 yearlings this year, because some kids, you know, or a new hunter wanted to take a yearling, that's not going to set you back. So awareness of what's out there and the goals you're setting for yourself and whether those are realistic, that's important. Some people can wait longer. Some people can wait longer for and watch a lot of 2- and 3- and 4-year-old bucks go by trying to get to something older, and others can't. You need to answer that question for yourself. Realistically, what do I want to achieve here? Can I wait that long? Do I have that kind of patience, or do I just want to enjoy the recreational opportunity of harvesting a little bit younger buck first?
Yeah. I think one, other big part of kind of hunting satisfaction that we haven't talked about yet, has to do with just the camaraderie around deer hunting. And I wonder, is it the case in your area? Does it seem like the hunting camp, just like the traditional hunting camp of folks all getting together in one place, an old shack, a cabin, to spend the weekend or a week together, does that seem just anecdotally like it happens less, or is that still going strong like it has, you know, back when you were a kid?
It's certainly still there in the South, for sure. I can't really speak to other parts of the country as much, because my understanding is that sort of Midwest and Northeast, you didn't see as much of the traditional, you know, hunting club like we have in the South, that generally tended to be, you know, folks that had leased some timber company land and set up a club and had a lot of members and did that. That's still there. I still see that. I still, you know, driving to my family land in South Georgia to go hunting, I see, you know, the camps out in the woods, and you see the trucks gathered around, and that's still there. And I know people that are still involved in them, but it certainly is fading. And I think that comes from land ownership trends. The big timber company properties are tending to be broken up. They're still there, but the trend is away from that. And you're seeing many more people buy small recreational properties for deer hunting, for their own deer hunting. People buying 50 and 100 acres for them and their family and maybe a few friends to hunt on. And it's no longer a club. That is private land. And, you know, that's how they're going to do it. That has grown. And as certainly as that has grown, it has cut into the number of the traditional hunting clubs and deer camps on the bigger timber company lands that are out there. They're still there, but, and I can't really quote you any stats that would, you know, support what I'm saying, but I feel confident, and we can look at changes in land ownership, changes in the average tract size that's out there, many timber companies kind of breaking up their big land holdings. You know, they no longer own as much timberland as they used to because it's no longer as affordable to own a whole lot of land and make timber income off of it. So some of those they've broken up and sold as recreational properties and taken that income that way. And that's led to, again, a different picture of land ownership out there across the South, certainly. And I know that has affected other parts of the country as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess where I'm kind of getting, I mean, that definitely checks out with, you know, what I've seen basically everywhere that I've gone deer hunting. And I guess where I'm getting with that is, you know, if you're hunting on a smaller property, just kind of to yourself, that can become a pretty solitary season. You know, even if you've got buddies who are hunting, but they're hunting their own stuff, and maybe you go, you know, help them recover a deer, but really, most of the time, you're just hunting on your own. And then if you don't get the result that you're looking for, that over weeks of hard hunting can start to feel not that fun. But if you get the experience of a deer camp, whatever kind of camp it is, whether it's a big club or just a little family camp or whatever, regardless of the outcome, you still end up having a good time, you know, because the hunt is about so much more than you just actually hunting. So I don't really have a recommendation here other than if you have the chance to go to a deer camp or host a deer camp yourself, you should do it because you'll have fun whether you shoot a deer, whether anybody shoots a deer or not.
I agree with that. Yeah, there's a social aspect. We all ought to embrace that. You know, in our Field to Fork program, which is our adult hunter recruitment program, one of the things we emphasize is the social support of hunting. Because that's really what keeps new hunters involved in hunting, is the social support, whether it is just the friendships or the come help me drag a deer or, you know, let's have venison dinner together or whatever. It's the social part. The, you know, when you come in from the woods at night and you know, what'd you see and tell the stories, that's hugely important. To the cohesiveness and the culture of deer hunting. And so we build that around, you know, with our adult hunter recruitment program. And yeah, I can see where, you know, you've bought yourself your small deer hunting property and you can lose that. You've got to actively try to maintain that, whether it is from getting to know some of your neighbors and maybe building kind of a camp club culture with them, whether it is inviting somebody in your community, getting to know somebody in your community who wants to learn to deer hunt and mentoring them and bringing them out there and sharing that piece of dirt with them and sharing those deer with them, being there with them when they get their first deer, sort of rekindling that group dynamic, that social aspect, using this small property that you hunt. It's important to keep that going, not just for yourself, but for anybody else that you introduce to hunting. If you've got enough land, you know, invite friends. I make a point to do that every year myself. I have a hunt or two, if I can, later on in the season where I invite friends of mine who don't have their own land. We all spend a big weekend and we hunt deer and we cook big meals and we have a great time and, you know, catch up on things. And it's as much of a social event as it is a deer hunting event. And that's, even though I'm big into deer management and habitat management and herd management and all that, I look forward to those hunts as much as any other, you know, rut peak deer hunt. So we all ought to maintain those things. And I'll say one more thing about this. Even if you own a piece of deer dirt, you're fortunate enough to afford to own your own piece of deer dirt, go to public land sometimes. Go back to that. Because I'll be honest with you, I've met some of the best people I've ever met in my life on public land deer hunts. You can do, for example, here in Georgia, we've got a number of barrier islands on the coast that are entirely public. Those are some rugged hunts. You know, there's no bridge over there. You got to get over there by boat. You camp on the island. It's small deer. It's thin deer populations. It's difficult hunting, but it's in very beautiful, remote, unique situations. And you're in camp with people you don't know. Hmm. A culture develops while you're there. You know, a brotherhood, sisterhood develops among the people that are in camp that you, and I, again, have met some of the best people through hunts like that. One of the earliest hunts I went on years ago was on Wausau Island National Wildlife Refuge on the Georgia coast. I'd never done it before. Went over there by myself. I'm camping in my little spare austere backpacking tent with my little dehydrated food. And
yeah.
And next to me in camp was this father and son who'd been doing this for years, and they had chairs and they had gas stoves and they had lanterns and they had good food, and they took pity on me and invited me into their camp. And it was one of the best hunts I've ever been on. They are some of the best people I've ever met. And those guys, they don't own deer land.
Yeah.
They hunt public all the time. Some of the best deer hunters I've ever met, serious about it. And yet their enjoyment came from sharing with others. They taught me about that island and places to go hunt. They shared their food with me. So, you know, go back to public, even if you own some private land. Public gets a bad rap. A lot of times we all know that, and we know the reasons why.
Yeah.
But sometimes going back to a quota hunt or a draw hunt or a public hunt near you, even if you own private land, can rekindle your enjoyment of deer hunting and introduce you to some people that are great, some of the greatest deer hunters and people you'll ever meet, and also rekindle your appreciation for having that private land. It has worked that way for me.
Yeah, man, that's such a great point. And it's one that I have heard other really experienced veteran deer hunters make as well, that have hunted a lot of private land and owned and managed land, you know, the whole deal. One of the other things that they like about going and hunting public land is the exploration part of it. You're going, it's new now. You're not hunting the same 200 acres that you've hunted for the last 10 years. You're hunting totally new ground. You have to learn new things. You have to try new tactics. And that becomes really intriguing to a hunter. You know, I think one of the mistakes, or maybe not mistakes, but just one of the things a lot of Midwestern and Southern deer hunters are overlooking is they try to capture this like big adventure hunt by going out west. You know, we want to do an elk hunt or, you know, a mule deer hunt, and all of that is cool and amazing and it is all worth it, and everyone should try to do it if they want to. But a lot of that same kind of spirit you can capture in your home region in some of these giant national forests. Like, it's out there. If you want to go backpack into a national forest and go whitetail hunting, you can do the same type of hunting that you would on an elk hunt, do the same amount of hiking, and have that same sense of adventure right here, you know, within your own state or within your own region, at least. And I think that is all related to what you're talking about.
Yeah. And it can be closer to home than you realize. You know, do your homework. You know, here's Lake Lanier right here outside of Atlanta, enormous Corps of Engineers lake, very popular, recreational boating, you know, houses all over it, right within the city limits of Atlanta. And the Corps of Engineers has these islands out there with deer on them. They do a draw hunt where you can literally draw an island that's yours to hunt with archery only during the fall. You have to get yourself over there. And it's a tough draw because it's popular. I haven't been drawn yet. But one of my goals is to take my fishing kayak, get over to one of those islands and kayak a deer out, you know, bow hunt and kill a deer. So right here in the shadow of Atlanta, there's this rugged, remote, you know, deer hunt in a very unique situation that would be really cool to do. So yeah, look around. People would be surprised at some of the adventure type hunting and rugged, sort of, you know, remote type hunting that's right here in your backyard. You don't have to even go out of state in many cases to do some really unique hunts like that.
Yeah. Okay. This is my last kind of line of question for you, Lindsay. Have you yourself ever fallen into these traps? You ever gotten too serious about it?
Yeah, I have.
What happened and how did you get yourself out of it?
You know, it comes down to going back to what we talked about with the neighbors, about worrying about deer that we had produced, maybe I'd seen on camera that other people were shooting. And I was definitely too focused on that.
Yeah.
Too worried about that. Too, you know, concerned about what can I do to hoard these deer and, you know, make sure that they aren't shot before the age that I want them to be killed at. And that, yes, just like anything else, when you get too serious about it like that, it can take the fun out of it. And I remember the experience that kind of turned me around on this many years ago. It was just after we started to realize that our efforts at balancing the buck to doe ratio now meant that rattling and grunt calls worked, where before they didn't really work very well. And one morning I rattled and this beautiful 2.5-year-old 8-pointer comes busting in. I got a good look at him, studied him in binoculars. He hung around for a while, you know, just a cool experience, and then wandered off. And the next morning at kind of the community skinning pole, a neighbor has a deer cooler with, you know, skinning rack a lot of people use. I rolled in there to see what was going on. And there's that 2.5-year-old 8-pointer hanging by his hocks on the skinning pole. Right. And there were two guys there I'd never met before who hunted a property that bordered our farm and had been invited to use, you know, the neighbor's skinning rack. There they were skinning this 2.5-year-old 8-pointer. So I was kind of presented with a choice here.
Yeah.
What could I do? Could I approach these people and be an asshole about it?
Right.
Or could I do something different? So what I ended up doing, and it wasn't because I really thought it through before doing it. It just kind of, it ultimately ended up being what came out of my mouth was going up and saying, you know, is this your deer? And one of the guys said, yeah, it's mine. I got him this morning. And I said, are you going to pull a jawbone? And they said, no, I wasn't. And I said, do you mind if I pull one? Because, you know, we would collect jawbones from most of the bucks and does that we harvested. And I would even try to get them from neighboring deer. Again, to try to collect some of that data, to look at what your average buck is by age class. And to understand the age of the deer you were killing so you could, you know, be better at field judging, et cetera. But so I did want the jawbone. And these two guys had never even thought about the age of a buck, never seen a jawbone pulled. So they were cool with it. They were like, yeah, they seemed curious. And I had a jawbone puller there and showed them how to do it, looked at the jawbone and explained to them why the deer was 2.5. I knew he was 2.5 just from having studied him in binoculars already.
Right.
But the jawbone confirmed it, that this was, you know, very clearly a 2.5-year-old buck. Showed them the jawbone, showed them, you know, how that worked. And they were kind of like, huh, you know, interesting. And I gave him the jawbone and said, here you go. Thanks for letting me take a look. Now, you know, I don't really have the end of the rest of the story. I don't think I ever saw those guys again. I think they were from Florida and were leasing some land nearby, and that changed, you know, people come and people go. But did I plant a seed in their mind about buck age that maybe paid dividends down the road? Did they begin to think about buck age where they hadn't before? I didn't say anything to them about how old, you know, they should be shooting deer. I just said this buck's 2.5.
Right, right, right. And you didn't, and you also, you did the very polite thing of not saying, well, I passed that deer yesterday.
Right. No, I didn't tell him that.
Which a lot of folks would have been tempted to be like, oh yeah, I rattled him in yesterday.
Yeah.
A lot of folks would have been tempted to say that.
A lot of people would have said,
which is not
to make,
that's not a nice, that's, yeah, that's not cool.
To make the point of, I wouldn't have shot that deer. You know, it's the same as the old, I wouldn't, you know, or the, you know, what people say about, he'd have been a good next year. You know, it's, yeah, it's right. Just passive aggressive, you know, it's,
yeah,
you are belittling their deer and belittling them.
Right.
And that's not what I wanted to do. That's not in me, I guess, as a person, but,
right.
So, you know, the point was, did I potentially plant a seed in their mind, teach them something new about age and get them thinking about the possibility of what if that buck had been 3.5? It's possible. One thing's for sure is that that would not happen. And if I had gone up there and said, I wouldn't have shot that deer. So if you have that kind of negative interaction with people,
right,
and you let that negativity eat at you, it's not only going to make it harder for you to enjoy hunting, it's not going to ever get your neighbors to go along with you or pay those kind of dividends and get people interested in doing the same thing on the lands that surround you. So the negativity can get you down. And it, again, certainly is not going to make you any friends in the neighborhood if you, you know, approach people from that negative standpoint of he'd have been a good one next year. So that was an experience for me that just made me realize that you got to lead by example, and you've got to not pressure people, not force them, but at the same time, because I had to step back and realize that, you know what, despite the fact that those guys killed that 2.5-year-old 8-pointer and took him home with them, we still have good hunting on our land. We're still seeing good bucks. We've produced some of the best bucks in the county based on county by county rankings that are collected. So we know we're growing some of the best deer in the county. We're happy with that. You know, we see it all the time. My brother-in-law, a few years ago, we got him into deer hunting. He married into a deer hunting family. Of course, you know, he became a deer hunter. We were pleased with that.
Yeah.
His first deer ever was a 2.5-year-old 8-pointer right there on our farm.
Yeah.
And we celebrated that with him. You know, it was not a, no, you shouldn't have shot that deer.
Yeah.
We celebrated that. And that's the way we all should be, is being inclusive and remembering that it's okay to share some of those deer with people, and you will still achieve things from a population management standpoint, from a buck age structure improvement standpoint, you're still succeeding. It's okay to see other people get some of those deer.
Yeah. No, it's, yeah. I mean, it's a great message. It's a, yeah, it's a hard one to learn, but I mean, you talk to experienced folks from, you know, all corners of the whitetail management country. They'll say the same thing. So you just gotta believe. And if you stick with it long enough too, you see that having a positive attitude about everything and just having a good, you know, kind of a good community spirit, you end up doing better. Like, you end up having better hunting. I just believe, I don't know if it's karma or you're just sharper in the stand because you're not all grumpy or whatever, but I do believe if you have a positive attitude through the season, you actually do better than those folks who just seem like they have storm clouds around them, you know?
Yeah, you do. You know, you enjoy every little moment. You enjoy the sunrises, you know, seeing other animals, enjoying wildlife. I mean, y'all, people pay for this kind of therapy.
Right.
You know, sitting in the woods is mental health.
Yeah.
It is good for you. And, you know, don't take that for granted. Seeing deer, even if it's a doe or even if it's a young buck, you know, those are interactions that we are privileged to have, and you should never take them for granted. So, yeah, you can definitely get too focused on, you know, what happened to that buck you had on camera. We've seen many bucks over the years that were great bucks that would have been, you know, on a wall somewhere, at my house or my dad's house or wherever, my brother's house, that vanished, and we don't know what happened to them. We don't know who got them. That's going to happen. A lot of those deer. We've seen others that the neighbors have killed. We celebrate with those, you know, with those folks. So you just have to remember you're not going to get all the big bucks out there. You can't take that approach that you're expecting to be the one to get them all. You've got to accept that some are going to be killed by other people. Some are going to vanish, and you're not going to know what happened to them. And it's just part of the mystery of hunting. But in the end, you're still enjoying better deer hunting than what you had before you were, you know, trying to manage the population.
Yeah. Well, Lindsay, thanks so much for all this insight. I feel good. I feel like a little more positive. Maybe I'll see that big buck after all. But even if I don't, I'll be happy if the neighbors get him too.
That's the outlook to have, Alex. You're gonna have a better season now.
Okay. Well, I'm working on it. I'm working on it every day.
The Outdoor Life podcast is edited and produced by me, executive editor Natalie Krebs. It's hosted by our editor-in-chief, Alex Robinson. Music in this episode was composed and performed by Jennifer Jordan and Eric Starkzan via APM Music.